Blog Talk Radio.
Well, thank you for joining Hot Wash. I'm author J.T. Patton, and today's guest in our Shooters and Spies interviews really falls inside the intelligence and espionage realm. So welcome, Mark Henshaw. Thanks for coming, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Just to give some of the listeners a little bit of your background, you know, you've got a really rather impressive career. Government intelligence analyst, over 15 years of service, a number of awards for innovation and intelligence capabilities. So, you know, suffice it to say, you know, along with the theme that we've worked with here on this show is, you know, we've got a real deal individual. So I appreciate you coming on the line. One of the things that I'd like to, you know, ask you right off is many of the listeners here are big readers for military thrillers, espionage thrillers. There's certainly no shortage of CIA involvement in a lot of these thriller books. More often than not, however, it's the sexier version of the operative, and oftentimes, you know, the word knock is thrown around. Now, your background, having been more in the intelligence analysis side, I was wondering if you could give some of the listeners a little bit of a 101 as to, you know, where the intelligence analyst fits in, you know, as opposed to the intelligence officers that many of them are familiar with and some of the other capabilities within the agency.
Yeah. Well, I mean, most people, you know, obviously just from, if nothing else, years of watching James Bond movies are familiar with the case officers, you know, the guys who are out running around in the field and doing that kind of thing. The analysts, they are a lot more academic. Their job is to, in a sense, play detective. They take all the information that's coming in from the field that's being gathered, and they try to piece together the puzzle, figure out what is really going on in the world. That's not to say that they're, you know, completely desk-bound. I mean, analysts, you know, get out to the field a fair amount. I've known some people, you know, over the years who ended up, you know, serving in war zones, you know, in the Green Zone and in Baghdad, or, you know, basically every other hot spot that you can imagine, so that they can be right there working with the case officers and people in the field, gathering information and putting it all together and trying to figure out those puzzles. So it's you can have sort of the best of both worlds there. You can, you know, be out in the field and you can do some interesting things, and then you can come back and, you know, take a breather, sit at the desk and, you know, have a quiet couple of years while you work on some kind of a bigger puzzle. But when you are back, you know, in the States, it's a much more academic kind of lifestyle, a lot of writing, a lot of reading, a lot of time spent downtown, you know, talking to policymakers, briefing people, trying to let them know, you know, the information that they need so that they can make the best decisions possible.
Sure. Great. Thanks. And would you say that, you know, more often than not, when you are an analyst covering a particular segment of the world and, you know, a hotspot appears and they may have to go out into the field, would you say that most of the analysts are looking to have that type of an opportunity, or would you say that more of them are kind of, you know, a bit reluctant to have to leave the confines of the ivory tower?
Well, you know, you kind of get all kinds. I mean, I've known some guys who, you know, not only did they not want to go out into the field, they never even wanted to change offices the entire time, their entire career. You know, they wanted to spend 30 years studying one subject. You know, I know a guy, you know, locked away in his office, didn't even turn the lights on. He just had one of the overhead reading lamps on and stacks of paper everywhere, and that was his happy place. You know, and if he had to even go downtown to give a briefing, he was unhappy. I mean, he was that sort of desk-bound. But, I mean, on his subject, you know, he was the man that you went to if you wanted to know anything about, you know, this particular subject. So there are those kinds. But, yeah, there are, you know, a fair number who are very definitely looking to get out from behind that desk, to go out into the field, to be on the front line, putting their analytic talents to work, helping people out there. I mean, and, you know, I've known analysts. Some of them had actually been case officers at one point in their lives, and they decided to transition out of that and be analysts. And so they sort of straddled that line, having lived out in the field for a number of years, and then they come back and they're analysts and they put all that case officer knowledge to work because they know, you know, they sort of know the limits of what case officers can find out, how they can find out things, you know, and they can integrate all that into their work. And then they go back out to the field and they know how to talk to the case officers. They speak that language. They understand that world. And so they're able to bring their knowledge from both worlds to bear on that problem. And some of them made some of the very best analysts that I ever knew. I wouldn't say that most of them are trying to get out into the field. I would say that a good healthy number is trying to get out there. And you know, I think the intelligence agencies in recent years have really seen the value of having more analysts, you know, get out from behind the desk and get a little more exposure and be working more closely with people who are on the front lines. It helps everybody all around, and it just results in better intelligence being provided to the policymakers.
Gotcha. And how well-trained would you say, and again, you know, within the limits of what we can share, how well-trained would you say many analysts are to go out into the field? I know that so many of the action movies that we see and a lot of the novels that we read where all of a sudden you've got the, you know, kind of bookworm analyst who finds themselves in the middle of a hot spot and, you know, now they have to become operationalized and, you know, they just kind of turn everything on. Would you say that many of them have some of the training and capabilities to actually execute what you sometimes see or read, or is it a little bit less far-fetched?
I'd say it's a little bit less far-fetched. I mean, you know, they certainly are not going to send anybody into a war zone or, you know, some kind of a hostile area without giving them, you know, a certain level of training, you know, to be able to, you know, watch out for themselves, watch out for the people that they're working for, those kinds of things. But that said, they are analysts and they're not expecting them to be going out and, you know, running high-risk operations or whatever. So there's still, you know, certain kinds of training that they don't get simply because they're not expected to be running those kinds of things. But, you know, I know some people who went out there and, you know, proficient with firearms and all of those kinds of things, and they were, you know, they were very good in terms of, you know, personal operational security and those kinds of things. But again, they're not expecting you to necessarily go out on the front line and be doing the really truly dangerous stuff for which you need to have people who, you know, haven't had just one or two training courses in this stuff. You need some people who've dedicated their lives to mastering these skills and, you know, repeatedly going through training and practicing these things, because all of these are highly perishable skills. So there are just certain kinds of jobs where, no, you know, the analyst is not going to be doing those things. When that needs to happen, they will call out the people who have the right kind of training and other things to be able to do that.
Right, indeed. You know, speaking of jobs, one of the things that came up in your background and really the theme of many of your books is about the red cells. I think that some listeners may be familiar with red teams, especially as it pertains now to from the cyber vantage these days where it's a little bit more, you know, in the news. But I don't know that so many really can tie in what the red teams, devil's advocacy groups, red cells do. Can you share a little bit about what a role would be like as an analyst in an actual red cell?
The red cell at the agency is a unit that was created personally by Director George Tenet on September 13th, 2001. He directly ordered its creation. The problem that he realized the morning of September 11th was that there had been what the 9/11 Commission later called a failure of imagination. Basically, you know, if somebody had walked in to the agency or the Pentagon or NSA or something on September 10th and said, you know, I think, you know, terrorists could, you know, seize multiple aircraft and go fly them into buildings and kill a lot of people. You know, you'd have been laughed out of the building. I mean, nobody would have believed
right.
that. And then on September 12th, they would have come to you thinking you were some kind of a prophet, you know, and they would have been hanging on your every word. And the reason why nobody would have believed you the day before is simply because it was something that was so far outside the realm of our experience that nobody could grasp that it was possible. You know, I even remember watching, I want to say it was late on September 11th, or maybe it was the next day, they had one of the news channels, CNN or somebody, actually had an interview with Tom Clancy, who had written about, in one of his books, somebody flying an aircraft into the Capitol building and basically wiping out most of the government. And somebody said, well, you know, you saw this. Why didn't anybody else see this? And Clancy's reply was, you know, well, you know, I sort of thought maybe it was possible, but I only thought it was one aircraft. You know, even I didn't, you know, I do fiction for a living. Even I didn't think anybody was going to be able to grab four of them. You know, so even a guy who specializes in, you know, crafting those kinds of stories, it was well outside of his experience. So George Tenet, you know, realizing that had happened and not wanting that to happen again, he ordered the creation of a red cell. And I knew the two guys who were the first two directors of it. And they were called into his office, and he said, look, he said, I want you to set this thing up, and I'm going to give you basically two directives here. Number one, I want you guys to tell me what nobody else is willing to tell me. You know, I want the ideas, I want the theories that are so far outside the norm that people, you know, don't even want to raise them, you know, in my office. And second, he said, I want you to make the other analysts around this place nervous, which was interesting. You know, and he says, I'm going to give you high-level cover, you know, to do this. Because you got to understand, a red cell is not a unit that is ever going to be really dearly loved within the agency it's set up. Because when you put together a unit of people whose whole job is to think contrary thoughts, it's the natural reaction of the bureaucracy to try and kill it. You know, agencies... You know, every government agency likes to speak with one voice. You know, they like to speak what they think is the consensus of what the people, you know, under their roof are thinking. And so when you have a group of people whose mission in life is not to follow the consensus, but to stand up and say, well, you know, we think it could go a completely different way, you know, that's the kind of thing where if you don't have top-down cover, you get crushed in a hurry. So they set up this unit, and that was their whole job. They started, you know, just looking at terrorists. And whenever somebody in the building, you know, in a meeting, you know, somebody would toss out an idea and somebody would immediately say, oh, that could never happen. They immediately jumped on that and would proceed to write a paper on exactly here's how that could happen. You know, I mean, it was that kind of contrarian thing. And they used a number of different techniques. You know, like you said, devil's advocacy is just one of them. You know, there's a lot of different ways that you can take an alternate view of things. And so for about a year they did that, and then after that, George Tenet came to them. He said, okay, now I'm going to take the blinders off, and I want you guys to feel free to write on any subject that the entire agency looks at. And so suddenly the world was their oyster, and they could write on any country, they could write on any subject, they could take a contrarian view. And, you know, I worked with those guys for several years, and it was one of the most stimulating times of my life because suddenly you weren't stovepiped into one account and you weren't tied down by the bureaucracy, you know, trying to knock out things that they didn't like to hear. You could write what you wanted. You know, I mean, you had to be, you know, logically rigorous and you had to have good scholarship. You know, you're not writing science fiction here, but... it was very interesting to be able to look at a problem and to come up with alternate scenarios that a lot of other people might consider, you know, not certainly not probable, and maybe in some cases even outright impossible. And you know, it's interesting how many times the Red Cell got it right. You know, and I can't tell you what times those are.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I came away from it convinced that every big agency that has an analytic unit in it ought to have a Red Cell in it. Sitting there being willing to sit outside of the majority and offer some contrary ideas and say, you know, I think maybe this could go a different way. And you know, they're going to be wrong most of the time, probably, but the simple fact is that they get people thinking. You know, what are some other ways that this could go? And if you do that, you find yourself surprised by events a whole lot less. And I think that's what we need if we really want to improve our national security.
I would agree. There was a number of years back that I had done a study on the red teams around the, you know, the intelligence community and DOD, and we were woefully lacking in many of the capabilities. And really, about the time that I was doing it, a lot of those were being kind of sloughed off. It was really, really kind of a shame because it did provide some much needed insights. So with, you know, with your experience on the Red Cell side, what is it that prompted you to write your first novel and have the focus being with the Red Cell?
Well, you know, I worked with them, like I said, I worked with them for several years. And when I decided to sit down and write a book, I thought, you know, it's a really interesting group because, you know, unlike most analysts in the building, again, they're not stovepiped. They can look at anything, which, you know, as a writer, gives you a lot of freedom. You know, you can take your hero and you put him in a unit which is free to look at, you know, any place in the entire world. So suddenly, you know, you can have your character go from, you know, being in China in one book to Russia in the next to Venezuela in the next, you know, to Iran in another one. And it makes sense because they're, you know, that unit takes a look at everybody. And it was also interesting because when I was there, you know, the unit did have connections up on the seventh floor of the agency. That's, you know, for people who don't know, that's up where the director is and all those kinds of people. And, you know, it was not uncommon for, you know, people in the Red Cell to be shooting papers up to the seventh floor, and the seventh floor was making comments on them. I was there one day when the, you know, deputy director of intelligence, you know, came down and directly tasked us to write a paper, said the president's not happy with, you know, some analysis is getting on the subject and he wants an alternate view. And so we sat there and we wrote this paper and it went straight to the deputy director and then to the director and went on to the president. And, you know, so it was interesting to be in a place where you could be receiving very direct taskings from very high level people. I mean, in that particular paper, we were only two levels removed from the Oval Office. So,
yeah.
You know, you look at those things as a writer, and you're like, yeah, there's some really interesting possibilities there to go anywhere in the world, look at any kind of a subject, and be communicating with the people who are making the decisions, you know, both in the building and also downtown. You know, these people make a decision, and suddenly the world changes. And that's very interesting because the stakes in your books can be very, very high, which is another thing that any good writer wants. So I thought that the Red Cell was just a perfect place to set a book.
Yeah, it's a great topic, and really your book is really different in how it focuses on that, but really from an authentic vantage. You know, that being said, how did the agency feel about you writing? I know that you and I both have to go through the professional review board, which can be a bit of a challenge. What was your experience in getting approval, or at least, you know, the review of equities?
Well, you know, the first several books actually, it wasn't that hard. I mean, you know, you work at a place like that for a number of years, and you get a pretty good feeling for, you know, what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say. And so I'd write the book and I'd kind of go up to the edge, you know, a little bit, but I sort of knew where the lines were, you know, not to cross them. And I submitted that first book of mine back in 2012 to the PRB. And, you know, there were a few things they wanted changed, but it was interesting that the stuff that they wanted changed was not the stuff that I had thought they would want changed. And And the stuff that I was sure they were going to have an issue with, they were okay. They were fine with it. So that was kind of an eye-opening experience. The first couple of books, you know, I got a good relationship going with them and, you know, tried to stay friendly with them. And I've really learned, you know, that when people say, oh, you know, the publication review board is trying to censor me. You know, no, they're not trying to censor you. You know, I've concluded 90% of the time when somebody says that, they knew perfectly well that they were throwing stuff in that the PRB was not going to clear, and they're just trying to gin up marketing for their book. You know, oh, read the book that the agency doesn't want you to read. Yeah, right. So, yeah, I mean, what the PRB does, it's a very important function. You know, they go through, and their whole job is simply to scrub through it and make sure that nothing is getting published, which is going to endanger sources and methods. It's that simple. And, you know, like I said, you work there for a number of years, and you come to understand exactly what those things are. You understand where the pain points are. And so they are very good at what they do. They're very professional about it. You know, I've sat down and had some very good discussions. I didn't always agree with the things that they wanted to change, but I understood why they wanted it changed. And so, they were willing to work with me as long as I was willing to work with them. And so we had a very good relationship. Now, that said, with this last book, this was actually the hardest one to get through. It took about 6 months this time. Normally, we were able to do it in about 6 weeks. This time, it took about 6 months because there were some, you know, the premise of the book, I can't go into it too deeply, obviously, but the premise of the book, you know, touched on some pain points in ways that I had not understood and had not anticipated. And so when they came to me and said, yes, we're gonna need you to make some changes, and in order to be able to make those changes that they were requesting, it required some pretty significant changes to the plot, which required some major overhauls of the book. So it took quite a long time to get this last one done. But again, like I said, they were willing to work with me as long as I was willing to work with them, and they made it very clear to me why they needed these things changed, and I couldn't argue with them, even though it was going to be a lot of pain for me to go through and change the book around. But we got it done, you know, and I was very happy with it, and they were very happy with it, and I, you know, look forward to working with them on the next one. It's, you know, a step that I wish that I didn't have to take. You know, it'd be nice to write a book someday on some subject that I didn't have to go get it cleared. But as long as I'm writing in this field, I understand it's going to have to happen, and I'm willing to do that.
Yeah, they are good and pretty easy to work with. I mean, it always does kind of, you do have to hold your breath when you see, you know, a number of things redacted. And as you mentioned, some of those things that really the general public probably knows quite a bit about, even though it hasn't been released, or things that you read about in thrillers all the time, but yet we can't say those. Other people can say those. And then sometimes, as I've been told through PRB before, the analytical inferences, you know, can tip a hand also. And that's often what, you know, what they can also balk at. So tell us a little bit then about the Red Cell series. I mean, I know, you know, the latest one is The Last Man in Tehran. You know, tell us a little bit of how you would describe the novels and give us kind of a rundown as to what they're about.
Well, the first one, which I was able to get published through Simon & Schuster, came out in 2012, and it's called Red Cell. And in that one, you get introduced to our, you know, two main characters. The first one is a case officer named Kira, or a former case officer. When you meet her, it's on an operation in Venezuela, which goes very badly. She gets hurt and ends up coming home, and for a lot of different reasons, looks like her career in the field is at an end, and so she ends up getting assigned to the Red Cell, where she meets Jonathan, who is her boss, who is, you know, he's an abrasive type in his own way, but he warms up to her. And in that first book, they actually end up having to go to China, where they have to try and connect with an asset over there who has information on a weapon that the Chinese are working on at a time when tensions are starting to flare over there. The second book, which came out in 2014, is called Cold Shot, and that one actually takes place in Venezuela. You may recall that, you know, President Ahmadinejad of Iran and Hugo Chavez of Venezuela were all buddy-buddy, you know, about 10 years ago, when they were signing all kinds of agreements. We're going to, you know, do all these joint ventures in Venezuela and build these factories and these other kinds of things. And I thought, well, you know, what if some of those joint ventures aren't the, you know, innocent businesses that those guys claimed that they were? So they go down there to go and uncover what's going on at one of these facilities, and things go south very quickly there. The third book was called The Fall of Moscow Station. That one starts when the body of a Russian general washes up on the shore of a lake in Germany. And from that, they trace back certain things that are going on with the Russian GRU. And this is happening at a time when an agency officer decides that he wants to defect, and the GRU takes him and squeezes him for information about all of the American intelligence personnel in Moscow. And Russia proceeds to immediately declare them all persona non grata and run them out of town. And so Kira ends up having to go into Russia to try and rescue somebody who has gone missing. And in doing so, she ends up having a showdown with a GRU officer who has been sort of in the background in the first two books. So the first three books make kind of a trilogy. I do sort of recommend reading those three in order. You can read them as standalones if you want to, but just, you know, understand that there is a narrative thread behind them, which is tying them all together, which comes to a head in the last one. This fourth one, The Last Man in Tehran, it is a standalone, but it does star Kira and Jonathan. And in this book, it starts off with a dirty bomb going off at the port of Haifa in Israel. You know, and if you think about Israel and you know, how small it is, you know, this is not a country that can afford to allow weapons of mass destruction of any kind going off on its soil. And even though it's just a dirty bomb, you know, still you think about what does it mean if you have to go and evacuate half of one of Israel's major cities because you have radioactive material coming down on it. So, you know, the Israelis, whenever something like that happens, they tend to decide that the best defense is a good offense, and, you know, out goes Mossad, and they start, you know, hunting down the people who are responsible for this. And through the course of the book, it becomes apparent that somebody inside the agency is helping them do this. And so the agency decides that they need to track down who this is, and they don't want this to be a counterintelligence investigation which drags on for years and years like some of them do. They, you know, given the amounts of information that, you know, leakers can now dump onto the internet in a hurry, they want to start finding and shutting these people down in a matter of months, if not weeks. So Kira and Jonathan get assigned to this problem, and they realize these things are all tied together, and before it's all over and done with, Kira ends up in Iran, working there, and she ends up crossing paths with Mossad and with Iranian intelligence and some other people before she comes home and is able to, you know, work on figuring out who it is inside the agency who's helping them out. So I've tried to, you know, in those four books, I've sort of tried to hit all of the major hotspots around the world, all the countries that have given us the most trouble over the last few years. I think about the only one I haven't hit so far is North Korea. And I'm a little bit afraid to write on them simply because, you know, things are developing over there so fast. Anything you write might be out of date by the time the book had hit the store shelves. So we'll see what happens over there. But I've got an idea for number five. But I won't talk about that now. I got to save some surprises.
So. Yeah, well, looking forward to it. I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of readers who may be a little shy to go with something that seems like a classic espionage novel where it's sometimes a little slower pace, a little slower burn, I think that you keep the momentum up and keep the suspense going, that it's really an enjoyable read, and I think it gives you know, a little bit of the hair of the neck raised, and it's certainly timely on the topics that you're hitting. So kudos to you for that. So Just as we've got about another minute to wrap up here, The Last Man in Tehran is available currently, and is it also on audio?
It is. You can get that on audible.com or otherwise, you know, through Amazon. It's Kindle hardback right now. Paperback will come out sometime next year. But